Welcome to Inspiring Futures. I'm your host, Ed Cotton. This is a podcast where we talk about the how, what, and why of the future.
Hello, my name is Ed Cotton. I'm the host of this podcast, which is called Inspiring Futures. The objective of what we're trying to do in this chat, and though we don't always achieve it, is to talk about the how, why, and what of the future. And really, it's our lens to have a conversation about all kinds of things. And I'm delighted that Heidi Hagmeier is my guest today. We have been talking to each other for a while. We've been trying to find time to do this. Heidi's been traveling up to all kinds of other things, which we're going to talk about a little bit today. But I'm delighted to have her as a guest. And as I do with all my guests, I ask them to kind of give me a little bit of a career history in sort of 30 seconds.
Okay.
How they got to where they are now.
Cool. Thanks for having me, Ed. I'm excited to be here. So career history, really fast. Went to school. Thought I was going to be a copywriter. I did start a copywriting FCB, realized there was this other weird group of people called planners, flipped over to planners, did that, wanted to go to the motherland of planning, so went to England for a little bit to learn the British style of planning, which I'm really grateful that I had that experience. London was not my jam. It was not my city. So I came back to New York and got the best of both worlds and decided to work at BBH in New York, so I got my British and my American blended together. I did that for a few years. It was fun. But eventually I kind of got a bit worn out by the industry. And when I was about 31 years old, I dropped out for a couple of years. I bought a truck. I drove around the country. I freelanced. So I freelanced at like Anomaly, Droga, Co-Collective, Sylvain Labs, places like that. And in that, really got an education in a lot of ways that different agencies work. And actually that there's more similarities and differences in the way that agencies work. Decided that I loved brand strategy, but I did not love brand strategy purely as a spark to get just to advertising ideas. So I opened my own agency called Wolf & Wilhelmina. And at Wolf & Wilhelmina, we did more fundamental brand strategy where we were just really helping companies figure out who they were, what they were all about, how they needed to go out into the world. That was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed that. While I was at W&W, I had this weird phone call, did some projects with the Obama White House, which was something I never thought was going to happen in my career. That kind of got me hooked into Obamaland, which is this loose network of people who are all hooked into the man. And from that, a couple of years later, got a phone call to see if I wanted to head up the engagement discipline at the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, which is Mark Zuckerberg and his wife Priscilla Chan's philanthropy to basically give away, I think, 99% of their wealth while they're still alive. So I left W&W in the hands of my partners, moved west, did Chan Zuckerberg. It was a pretty intense year, to put it lightly. I don't think the year was entirely worked out the way that you would want it to on paper, although I am confident that in the end I will see why things went down the way they went down. I ended up getting fired from Chan Zuckerberg in August and then came back to New York City pretty wrung out. I was living a bi-coastal lifestyle, trying to start up this new thing at Chan Zuckerberg while keeping an eye on my company. It was a lot. Came back to New York. My partners decided that they didn't want to run W&W anymore. I did not have the energy to come in and take back the helm again. So I closed W&W, and I basically like just went and curled myself up on a couch for a while after that. And here we are. So that's
pretty great.
That's basically it in 37 seconds, maybe.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
39 maybe.
Okay.
So let's go backwards. Let's go to FCB in your copywriting.
Yeah.
And how did planning come into your life? Was it something you knew about before you went into copywriting?
No idea. I went to school. I studied advertising, but planning was not even a discipline that was acknowledged.
Which is so surprising, isn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. But also, we have to remember my age. It was quite a while ago.
Yeah.
So, you know. And but then all of a sudden I ran into planners, and I wasn't a very great copywriter, but And I think the reason I knew I wasn't a great copywriter was whenever I got a brief and I was looking at the blank page, I was terrified. But then once I switched over to planning, whenever the brief would come in and I was looking at the blank page, I was excited. And that was the big difference for me between the two things. So I was very lucky at FCB that they gave me runway that I could try planning. And if it didn't work out, go back to my job as a copywriter.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, not everyone's going to get that opportunity.
Yeah, that's so true.
That's good. So you do that. And then, so when did you discover, when did you think the London thing was important?
I mean, it's everywhere, right? Like everywhere you go, you're hearing a British accent in the planning world. And my mentor, Pele Cortizo Burgess, although he is from New Zealand, he studied in London for a while. So I always had that London thing in my head that that's something you need to do.
Yeah.
And so when Pele left FCB, then I also left FCB and went to London.
Cool.
Yeah.
So why was it not fitting with you?
Well, I think I'm an immigrant kid. My father's German.
Yeah.
And growing up as an immigrant kid, you hear this all the time, you kind of have a split identity. You don't really know, like, am I American, am I German, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went to London, I realized how much an American I am. Like, all of a sudden, it was like, oh no, you're American. And I think something that I really missed about New York, and I think that's the other thing, New York kind of makes you into a weird creature.
Yeah.
Like, if you morph to New York, it's
because New York
hard.
Isn't America, really, is it?
It's not, but it's also just in itself like a weird place.
Yeah.
And if you become a creature of the city,
mm-hmm.
you kind of have a hard time in other places,
yeah.
you know? And so I think the combination of me being American and me being a New Yorker, what made that difficult in London was that I was optimistic and I really like wanted to take runs at things. And I have to say, like, the thing that killed me about London was like not having that excitement around a creative idea and I understand, like, it makes for smart work in the long run, but when an idea gets put on the table in New York and America, my experience is everyone's like, it's immediate pile on of like how we're going to make it happen, and in London it's an immediate pile on of how it's not going to happen. And
which is exactly why I'm here.
And it kind of wore me down. I was like,
yeah.
I missed that excitement. I'm like, oh, I'm such an American.
Yeah.
There's
this great clip that is exemplifies the differences between the two cultures so
right.
well. It's Robert Smith. He's the Cure of being inducted in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this MTV-esque reporter, female reporter, and she is, this is such a big day, and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, this is the greatest band in the world, you know, finally getting their dues, and blah, blah, blah. And she puts a microphone in Robert Smith's face and goes, how excited are you, Robert? Well, clearly not as excited as you are.
Yeah, that's basically it. That's basically it. So I lasted about 14 months and realized that I needed to be back in New York.
Yeah.
And that's when I came back.
So that was a lesson.
That was but it was great. I'm glad I
yeah.
did it.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, I needed to come back here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're back here and you're back, you know, you're at BBH, and which is, you know, recognized as a great hotbed of planning, thinking,
yeah.
and respects planning.
Mm-hmm.
So you, as you said, you got that mix of a British
mm-hmm.
culture within an American situation. So deciding to get out of advertising and doing your own thing, was that a hard decision?
Well, when I dropped out of BBH, it was like a lightning bolt decision. It was, and I think what it really was happening is that I was just really burned out, but I didn't realize it because I was so in. You know how we get into our agencies?
Yeah.
But my body had been breaking down for like 6 months. If you look at my health records for the 6 months before I left, it's like, Jesus, like, that's a problem. And so, like, this thing came in being like, you have to leave, you have to go buy this truck, you have to go drive around. And if there is something...
I was thinking
yeah.
about Supersize Me. I was thinking, well,
yeah.
it's a sort of a parallel experiment that somebody works in advertising intensely for 6 months and we go check, see what's happening to their body every week.
I mean, we should,
yeah.
maybe. You know, especially through
a
pitch cycle.
It's a frightening experiment.
I bet that would be frightening, actually, if you did. That's actually a really good point.
Because
yeah.
you're not eating, you're not sleeping, you're not really looking after yourself.
No.
You're,
no natural light.
Yeah, the interesting, you know... when you get into the system one, system two thinking kind of whole thing,
mm-hmm.
there's a reason system one exists, is because our body, our brain tells us that you know, we don't ostensibly want to be, we shouldn't, it's not safe for us to be using all that energy.
Interesting.
So when we are using our cognitive capacity at max, we must be burning through ridiculous amounts of energy that we're probably not replenishing and not in the right way. We're going to the snack machine and getting what we can.
Exactly. Yeah. And so that was my life there for.
So what was there a moment where you said enough is enough? Or was there a kind of a point in time where you said, okay, was it getting sick? Was it?
I literally was at my desk and like this voice came into my head and was like, drop out, buy a truck, drive around America. And within a month,
sort of like a divine intervention.
It really was. Yeah. I know that sounds freaking crazy, but it really was. And within a month, I was gone.
So, have you bought a truck before?
No, I never bought a vehicle before because I lived in New York City, and I was actually scared to buy a vehicle. So I went back home to Wisconsin under the watchful eye of my brother-in-law, who's like a dude.
Yeah.
And he helped me buy a truck.
That's great.
Yeah.
So, did you actually sell it in Wisconsin?
Bought the truck in Wisconsin, drove to New York to finish up packing up stuff, and then left from New York.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so, did you have a plan, or was it just get on the road and see what happens?
The latter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so what happened?
A lot of nothing happened.
Yeah.
You know, I cried a lot in the beginning.
Yeah.
And I slept a lot.
Yeah.
So 4 months, I call that the great exorcism. It's just crying and sleeping, pretty dramatic and emotional in retrospect. But then I started to explore, and I started to, you know, I learned in this era a lot about meditation. I learned about what happens on reservations in America. Mm. I learned about our national park system. I learned about farmers more, and which is, my mother comes from a farming family, so that was really cool.
Yeah.
But it was a big moment of just exhale and then absorption.
Mm-hmm.
And people always say to me, like, didn't you write a book? Didn't you, you know, make a movie? And
why didn't you?
Yeah. And there was just something really freeing about doing nothing and just being.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense, because you've been through so much, and you needed to.
Yeah.
And your system needed a break.
It did.
So you're basically recharging your batteries is kind of,
but in that era, and then again now.
So it's
funny. I'm back again.
But did you feel you look, because I'm interested in this whole New York isn't America kind of thing. Because I started my U.S. career in Seattle, and I'm really grateful for that, because I feel it taught me a lot about the country.
Yes.
That I wouldn't have learned if I'd just come to New York.
I think that is a danger, especially for anyone from the industry that just comes to New York and stays in New York, that it's not that it's not the country, it's just a different vibe, it's a different area of the spectrum of the country. But if you're a planner coming here from England and you only live in New York and LA, I wouldn't put you on like a middle American. I don't know how you can actually work on an account that isn't a millennial coastal account, because you know, what people deal with in Wyoming and the Midwest and Texas is just way different than this life here.
Yeah. And how they approach it.
Exactly.
It's completely different.
Exactly. I always tell people, if you want a shortcut, you got to read the Bible. Because so much of the middle of the country, even if people aren't going to church, is driven by the morality that you find in the Old Testament. And so if you want a shortcut to understanding the underlying principles of America,
the morality code.
Yeah. Read the Old Testament.
Yeah. Well, that's good. That's good advice.
Yeah.
And it's a hard thing for someone who's been working in New York for a few years to actually go, oh, I need to do that.
Yeah.
So you're driving the truck around. Eventually that comes to an end. Is it like, okay, I've accomplished what I wanted to accomplish?
No, I still yearn for the truck almost every day. it was more, there was something though about, you know, when I would run out of money, I'd go freelance, and I was what I would call an assassin in agencies.
Yeah.
And that got to be tiresome. I missed having a team.
Yeah.
And I wanted something a little bit more out of my career at that moment. And I can kind of see that pulse can happen, like where it's good to be a hired assassin for a while, and then it's good to go build something for a while, and then it's good to be a hired assassin again. You know, like, I don't think these
sort
things are linear.
Yin and yang of these things that we kind of need, need to test ourselves, but then need the power of the team.
Yes.
And go back and forth between those. It was interesting for me because I kind of found that being based here but working for an agency in San Francisco was a radical change for me because I'd been so, you know, I'd been 20 years for and doing all kinds of planning for being sort of the only person in helping creatives write copy.
Right.
To
right.
writing big picture stuff. And how, that was a big learning for me. How was I going to add value from thousands of miles away?
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big, you know, shift in terms of like how do you work. You don't have your team around you, but there's a lot of things you can do. Which is back to that kind of lone assassin kind of model. So you decide that you've got more.
Yeah, it's time to try something new.
To do something new.
Yeah.
And how did you pull the company together? How did this work?
It was an accident, really.
Yeah.
It was decided to just go straight client side. Got a client that believed in me.
Yeah.
Had a person that was excited about being employee number one. And I really thought in the beginning that W&W was going to be something where I still continued the freelance lifestyle, where I would take on projects for periods of time and then travel, assemble teams, disassemble teams, that kind of thing. And W&W would be the vehicle through which to do that. But it just very quickly took on a momentum and it turned into like a thing. And I'm grateful that it turned into a thing. Like, I really enjoyed my W&W years. But it's funny how you have this intent in the beginning and then it changes. And actually being okay with it changing. It was good.
Yeah. And that was just because people kept calling and you didn't want to turn stuff down? Or
a little bit of that, and which is a great problem to have. I'm never going to complain about that problem. Another decision that I made really early that I never realized would actually veer it more towards company was that in wanting to work with younger talent, I inherently did not think it was fair to put them on the variability of freelance in the way that I feel like a senior person can kind of handle that. And so I felt an obligation to hire in some of this younger talent that I was working for so they could have things like health insurance and 401k and all that kind of stuff. And I had this idea in my head that despite the fact that I would have younger employees, like my first employee was quite young, a junior employee, that the junior employees and I could pulse on and off. But it just somehow, when you start to employ people, when you start to have payroll, when you start to build those operations, that pulsing thing doesn't seem to work as well. And that's a big learning for me.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. It's the challenge of the business, you know, which is, you know, how do you make all this work? And the challenge of, like, why we haven't seen, you know, there was this brilliant UK concept Charlie Robertson put together called Red Spider.
Okay.
And the idea was that all these planners who decide to leave the agency land but still want to be strategists would be sort of a loose federation, and that they would kind of work independently. And the dependently thing, it's weird. It's like planners don't work in teams. They work independently. When the world is moving towards much more of a team-based model, planners are still these sole agents. Creatives have the benefit, and it's not really that one is an art director and one is a writer. It's, yes, they are, but they ultimately, over time, they're just sounding boards for each other.
Yeah.
And there's something powerful about that. And I think where planners struggle is because they are kind of on their own, and this is where you sort of get the mental health issues. So, like, I'm asking myself all these. I have to be the person, and that's quite a lot of pressure especially for people who are young. They've got to walk into a room and someone points a finger at them and says, "Well, what's the strategy here, or what's the brief?"
Yeah, it's interesting. I never actually thought about that before, but it's so true. I remember that having intense pressure like that when I was younger, and I think in a way W&W was a bit of a wonderland in that it was an agency only of strategists and planners, and you would have two or three planners on a project. And they would be bouncing and riffing and playing with each other. So I thank you for reminding me that. I actually kind of forgot about that because my last experience and what we built was teams of planners planning and riffing and getting it done.
Yeah. So contrast that world. You've been intentionally involved in the agency world in different guises.
Yeah.
As a planner and planning department, so now you've got your own thing. Mm-hmm. How did your conversations with clients change?
Oh, I loved it.
Yeah. What was different about it?
They were just blunt. I would just say, that's bullshit, or this is what we can do for you. One of my favorite things to say to a client is, this is what we don't do. I think there were so many times in agency, especially as I got more senior and as agencies were freaking out about the way the landscape was changing, that they would promise the sun and moon and stars to clients and say they could deliver things that they couldn't deliver just to stay relevant. And I got caught in that a few times when I was freelancing. And
Do you think there's two things? So one is, we can do everything, and then the other is a massive amount of conservatism, that you don't want to take risks, that the agencies, because the pressures are on the business, that they ultimately they back down. And they're not candid. Whereas you're saying, well, I have a conversation with my client who is my client. Mm-hmm. I'm a little bit more candid, and I call bullshit.
Yeah.
It's something you couldn't really do necessarily.
Not an agency. And I mean, and let me just be very clear: calling bullshit does not have to be disrespectful or rambunctious.
Yeah.
But I found in my experience that clients were really grateful to just have honest conversations about the work, about the projects, about what could be delivered, what couldn't be delivered. And there's just something really nice about trying to get things black and white. Like, I do believe that the world is gray for the most part.
Yeah.
But to be able to just say, like, no, like, this, we can't do this, or like, this timeline's not going to work, instead of trying to hedge.
Over-promising.
Yeah, that was nice.
Yeah.
That was nice. It made me feel, I think they respected us for it. Mm-hmm. And it made us feel like we were really partnering with them. I know we talk about that a lot in the agency world. We're partners to our clients, blah, blah, blah. But I think you have to be willing to have tough conversations and be willing to walk away from business in order for you to be really seen as partner. And we did walk away from a lot of business at W&W that wasn't right for us. Scary. Really, really scary. But, you know,
especially when you got overhead.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, the thing, we always just had this confidence, like, it's going to work out. It's going to work. And it did. It did.
So, and what was your criteria when you said walk away from clients? Was it because they were asking for too much for too little, or their deadlines were, or was it sort of more of a cultural fit?
It was a lot of things.
Yeah.
Like one thing that I really refused to do was bend on our terms of payment. It's not my job as a small business to be a line of credit to Verizon. It's just not, you know. And if you're going to give net 180 terms to me and spend, in addition to 3 months of being in procurement to actually get the first contract done before I can even invoice you for the first one net 180, like, I cannot survive on that system.
Right.
So payment terms actually knocked out a lot of clients.
That's interesting.
We had a rule that we didn't do emails after 7 or weekend work.
Okay.
Most clients loved it.
Yeah.
Most loved it. We did lose a few because
of
that in the negotiation phase, because they just were like, no, like, I'm hiring you, I expect you to be on call 24/7. And I were like, no.
Yeah.
So it's things like that.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I mean, what you were trying to do is create an alternative, a little bit of an alternative universe from where you were before,
mm-hmm.
and what you've been experiencing, and then you have to, you know, you have to lay down the law if you want in sense of integrity, right?
Yeah, and most 90% of clients, 90% of our incoming was like, cool.
Yeah.
As long as you have the conversations up front, that's the thing. You have to have these conversations before you sign the contracts.
Yeah.
And then you're good.
So, that then takes you into this
weird Chan Zuckerberg thing.
Well, before that you said you had the call from Obama's Obama people.
Yeah, they and this was a total pro bono thing where they were looking for who they consider to be private sector experts to come in and do sprints and help them with contain problems that they had. I don't know if I can really talk about the problems.
You can talk conceptually about it.
I can talk conceptually about it. Yeah. So can you cut that little, I don't know if I can talk, because I don't want the Secret Service to come after me. So they had, they learned from healthcare.gov. And healthcare.gov, when that whole catastrophe happened where they spent hundreds of millions of dollars to build a website that didn't work, the administration got on the phone right away from a bunch of guys in the Valley who are like real startup guys who worked in healthcare and said, can you fix this? Todd Park came in. He was the first chief technology officer of the United States of America, which is like the best title in the whole world. And from that came a mentality of sprints are good, and you can bring in private sector people who will donate their time to do sprints on behalf of problems that the administration has. And so I did two of those sprints, and it was a huge eye-opener doing that, because I was very apolitical before that.
Did it change?
When I went to the White House, I thought I was either walking into the ineptitude of the Postal Service or the Machiavellian nature of House of Cards. I thought it was either one or the other. And I have to say, when I went to the Obama White House, I found a lot of really smart people who really cared and who took this concept of serving their country very seriously. I mean, it was almost like Boy Scout. And I was really surprised. I was super surprised by that. And it gave me hope. And I know that sounds like really cheesy, but I became a bit of a believer that like service matters and you can do things in your country to impact your country. And so I wouldn't say that I'm enthralled with our political system. And there is a lot of dirty shit behind every single candidate. Like, there are machines behind these candidates, and those machines are not great machines. But this idea that we can have impact on our communities around us, that we can serve, my mind changed.
There are smart people who actually want to do something good.
Yeah. Yeah.
And fight through the bureaucracy to get things to happen is inspiring.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Obama White House, in many ways, was a slightly magical place. And I say that as someone who was converted to that. Like, I didn't walk in. I voted for Obama, like we all did, you know, all that stuff. I mean, not that we all did. I'm sure you have a varied audience here.
But, many people.
As many of your listeners probably voted for Obama. But I wasn't like an Obama Kool-Aid drinker until I hit the White House and I was like, oh, there is something special going on in this administration.
And so did that force you to think into that you could be using your skills in other ways?
Yeah, and so that's like when Jason Harris, who's the CEO of Mechanism, he and I started the Creative Alliance, which was all about bringing together people in the industry to do campaigns for good that were hooked to big social movement platforms.
I didn't even know about that.
Yeah, so we did that, and that was
fun. I did like 10 something plus years ago, did this thing called Planning for Good.
And probably the same,
it was planners working on problems for nonprofits.
Perfect. Yeah. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
So we did that, and you know, it was. I do think we can use our skills for good, but it also means that we have to really listen and understand people that do change in other ways, and that was something that I was exposed to at Chan Zuckerberg. So at Chan Zuckerberg, you have all these people who are experts in change, but they come at change from a lot of different angles and a lot of different ways. Even the word campaign is like a contentious word, because what a campaign means to us
is
much different.
Temporary.
Yeah. So what a campaign means to somebody that works in politics.
Yeah.
One of the hardest things at Chan Zuckerberg was actually getting the words smoothed out, so you could understand what campaign means to a social movement worker versus someone who comes from our world. You know what I mean? Stuff like that. So yeah, that was interesting. It takes patience to do it.
So we'll just go back to the Creative Alliance. I'm just curious for a second. What was the motivation behind that? That obviously there were a bunch of people who wanted to give you good stuff. Is that what you thought? The reason we did Planning for Good was we thought there were a bunch of talented juniors who weren't getting a chance to shine.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing was that I had personal experience. We did a few projects for Amnesty.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've always noticed with agencies is it's always a quid pro quo. It's always, you know, we're doing a non-profit, but it's for selfish. It's for selfish reasons.
Right.
It's ultimately to do something provocative that wins. There's something like a slam dunk in award shows where the provocative non-profit it's got a good chance of capturing people's imagination because it's got license to do so much more than a brand can do, and it deals with much more controversial topics.
Yeah.
But an agency is doing it for its self-interest to get those gold medals, lions.
Yeah. And I can't speak for everyone that was in the Creative Alliance, or still is, because it's still going. I'm sure there was some of that from the agency side.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, Jason Harris really set a good tonality with Mechanism and the work that they did on the It's On Us campaign. It's not that any of that work, there's not a film there that's going to go sweep Cannes or anything like that. But that work is tremendous in that it really did create real impact in the country and got the conversation on sexual assault, gave that conversation a vessel on college campuses. And so
it's important work.
And it was important work. And that was the thing. When you have the firepower of some of the people that we had with the administration, like, it's on us as a Joe Biden campaign.
Yeah.
Right? So you know it's going to have impact, right? So there a lot that I think was motivating to a lot of people in the Creative Alliance.
I think that's good. I think there's the meaningful really being able to show that advertising or communication has power to do to positive make positive change.
Definitely.
And I just feel it's I don't know, I feel one of the things I'm thinking about, I'm starting to talk to agencies about strategy from a conceptual point of view about what is strategy and what it means to have good strategy and what it looks like. I think the industry is terrible at explaining the difference between good and bad and talking about its impact and the impacts of creativity. It talks to itself.
Agreed.
It's a bubble. It's not a broader conversation.
Because
when you go, it wasn't this year, the year before I went to the one show, the dinner, the awards. And I actually ended up writing a piece for Ad Age, because you listen and you hear about the award winners, and it's incredible work. And it's stuff like a flag for refugees, some technology around Braille. I mean, it's not a shitty campaign. There's so much more than that. The application of creative ideas, and one of the things. One of the things that interests me as well is, like, for an industry that's trying to reconstitute itself, surely, if its core asset is creativity, it has to deploy that asset in new and imaginative ways. And it surprises me what's the blockage in the industry to say, look, you've got really smart strategists, the best agencies have really smart strategists. They're understanding consumers, they're understanding markets, and you've got really good creative people. Why are agencies not going to the Valley and getting $150 million for a next new idea? It seems that there's some barrier, some myopic definition of what creativity is and the boundaries in which that lies that seem to constrain. I think maybe people, creatives, feel, I'm not going to get a prize for setting up a new business.
Perhaps. It's a really good question. I mean, having just come back from the Valley, I do know that there's a bit of, data has supremacy over creativity. And creativity, everyone wants it, but they actually don't want to bother with it. So everyone wants the amazing film, right? Anyone in the Valley wants it. Do they want to pay for it? Do they want to go through the creative process? Do they want to deal with what it takes to get to that? No. And I don't think that we've advocated enough for ourselves in an industry saying, like, this is a craft. There is something to this. There's something that takes time and resources and energy that we need to put into this, because therefore it will have this effect on the businesses. I think this is compounded by, you have your YouTube stars that just whoosh, put something up and it goes crazy. And, creativity has changed. So it's partially, I don't think we advocate enough for what it takes to create great creative. On the other hand, I think we've been a bit slow, more than a bit slow, to adjust to the new rules and parameters of creativity. So we look like dinosaurs, right? And you have this pushing on the bottom of these kids that are coming up that can make stuff faster, cheaper, and quote unquote viral. And, the industry just kind of looks silly.
Yeah. I mean, I look at the Droger work for New York Times, and I the latest work, and I go, you can't watch those ads and be impartial to the power of good journalism.
Right.
And be ambivalent to the power of good journalism. And it feels to me like the ad industry should be doing its own version of that.
That's interesting.
And I wrote something on LinkedIn the other day. It was some Ad Week piece that someone had posted about industry in crisis, and I was like, why doesn't the industry get together and actually advertise itself?
Right. Right.
Because, I mean, if you believe in what you do,
yeah,
you back what you do,
right,
and then you believe it enough that it's going to make a difference. And if it doesn't make a difference, there's your point. I think it's made the same point.
Totally.
It's become self-fulfilling.
Well, and we've also been talking about the industry in crisis for at least 10 years now. I find it to be quite a tiresome conversation at this point. And that's like also, that was one of the things that motivated me to start W&W, was I was so tired of hearing everyone complain about things inside of agencies that I'm like, well, let me just start my own that works on the way that I want to do it. I think one of the issues that we have is that there's so much inertia in the agency structures. There's so much committed capital into what's been built. There's so much commitment to the system of the way that we think creativity works, that it's very hard to move those ships, right? And so I think we have to stop complaining as an industry and start celebrating difference in, like, people that are trying, people that are doing. But it, like, look, you open up Ad Age and you open up Ad Week. Like, W&W never got into any of those publications because we didn't have a PR person, because we couldn't afford it. Which is crazy. It's crazy. Like, this whole conversation around women in leadership and diversity, like, we predated that by 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we were doing a really progressive form of brand strategy way before a lot of other shops were doing it. But because I didn't have the right PR people, and I didn't have the right schmoozy contacts at these pubs, you still get the big giants on the cover. Now, obviously, they're creating more volume, more revenue. They're bigger things in the industry. But I think our industry in ourselves is actually dictated by who has the PR muscle. And so the stories that get told in the industry are about the same people over and over again. And the innovators in the industry, because they don't have the resources to schmooze with Adweek,
yeah,
get those ideas aren't bubbling up.
Voice, yeah.
They're not bubbling up.
Yeah.
And so in a way, like, I think we kick ourselves in the foot. Like, go to any conference, it's the same speakers over and over again. Judging panels, it's the same people. I'm guilty of this. I'm starting to turn into one of those people that shows up in all the podcasts and judging panels and stuff like that. Where are we allowing as an industry? Where is our generosity to be like, we have to support the smaller agencies that are bucking up against things? Because if not, then things like VidMob are going to eat us for lunch. So we either have to embrace the change.
Explain what VidMob is.
Yeah. Oh, VidMob is this, it's this agency that they've basically systematized. It's a social creative agency where they can make four or five Snapchat stories in like a day.
Yeah.
And it's by crowdsourcing the creativity in a new way, but they use hardcore data and analytics. They are on all the platforms. If I were a creative agency right now, I would be terrified of VidMob, because they're just, I mean, the creativity is just like boom, boom, like boom, you know, put out a ton, but they can actually do it. Like what we talk about, like, we're going to put out a lot of ABs and we're going to do all this stuff. They do it literally like in less than a week.
Right.
And it's effective.
Yeah.
And it's working.
Yeah.
And yet we're still talking about Ogilvy, and we're still talking about these dinosaurs, when it's like, we need to be, like, where are we? Not that Ogilvy's a dinosaur, like, I don't mean it that way, but the same names keep popping up,
yeah, yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, how do we actually, as an industry, embrace the innovation and embrace disruption as an industry?
Yeah. I mean, just to summarize, kind of summarize.
Sorry, that was a rant.
No, it wasn't. It was good. It was good. I think kind of just to summarize what you just said, I think is it's really the bubble effect. It's the filter bubble. It's the same people talking over and over again,
yeah,
to themselves. And given that the conversation is generally negative, that kind of perpetuates this overall cynicism and skepticism that is, pervasive in the industry. Yet, scratch underneath the surface, look under there, and you will find, you know, gems of interesting stuff. In the crisis and the chaos and the despondency, there is actually positivity and hope.
Hey, Game of Thrones, chaos is a ladder, right? And
yeah,
like, there are a lot of small, interesting shops that
yeah,
are doing stuff.
Yeah.
And we keep talking about how the industry is doomed. It's like, actually just go talk to the people that are innovating. Talk to the shops that are 5 to 10 people.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was a couple of years ago, I was at a Mirren new business conference, you know, Mirren.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And there was a question at the beginning, and it was like, how many of you experiencing headwinds? And 90%
sure
put out their hand.
Sure.
And then how many are you experiencing tailwinds? And this handful of people put their hands up. And I happened to be at an informal networking lunch, and I happened to be at lunch with one of the people who put their hands up. And said they were experiencing a tailwind. And I asked her, she was an Australian woman, probably 28, 29.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, tell me your story of what's going on. And it was just remarkable. She had been in New York at JP Morgan,
mm-hmm.
but not in the big investment analyst space on Wall Street. She'd been working in sort of corporate banking, small business banking.
Mm-hmm.
And in her side activities, she had an Amazon business. And what she discovered was that all her friends were coming to her asking how they optimize for Amazon.
Mm. Mm.
And she left JP Morgan and she created an agency.
Mm-hmm.
She was 18 months into it as an Amazon advisory agency.
Mm-hmm.
What was fascinating was that she was running the business from Medellin, Colombia.
That's awesome.
Although she had employees in the US,
right.
She decided that Medellin, Colombia was a wonderful place to be. She loved the city, loved the people, loved the place. Her and she was married with kids, and
yeah.
That's where they wanted to be.
Great. Good for her.
So you're right. I mean, it's just fascinating.
They're everywhere.
There are these amazing stories that they just don't get
but
enough airtime.
Who's going to be at Cannes next week?
The same people.
Who's going to be there?
Yeah.
Who are we going to be celebrating? Who's going to be on the
So maybe there's
page?
An idea here. Maybe there's an
no,
alternative. isn't there sort of like the Oscars have the Independent Spirit Awards.
Yeah.
The Sundance has the Anti-Sundance. It's almost like, you know, maybe there's an opportunity here to shine a light on the innovators, the unpredictable innovators, and the fantastic stories that are coming, thriving from the chaos.
Yeah, I mean, I would be very interested in a conference that was about agencies that are 5 years young and less, or did I say that correctly? But whatever, you know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
Like, that is a conference I'd be interested in. That is an award show reel that I'd want to see.
Yeah.
Like, that is, those are business whose operational models I want to understand and see
yeah.
what they're doing.
Yeah.
And so, like, hey, 4A's, wake up. Like, put those people on the pedestal. That's who needs to be on the pedestal. But we as an industry just cannot let go of the mutual masturbation that we have created with our PR companies. And so that makes me very uninterested in the industry.
Yeah. Yeah, the same story, same people, nothing
yeah.
new.
Yeah.
Move on.
Yeah.
Where is the interest?
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
I didn't even think we were going to talk about that today.
It was inevitable.
Yeah, there you go.
It was inevitable. It was going to come up. It had to come up with
yeah.
both our backgrounds. So let's switch gears and let's
okay.
talk about passions, and you know, passions is the fuel for personal growth, which
yeah.
is a little bit of a conversation we had earlier. And you talked about writing, so it's almost like going full circle. So you started in writing,
yeah.
You went into planning, did a whole end of other things, and now you're back to writing. Do you want to talk about how you got back to writing and where you're heading with that?
Well, I mean, I don't know if this is the master plan moving forward, but a couple of months ago, I submitted a sample to do a writing workshop. I was a creative writing major in college. I don't know how good I was. I don't know. But, you know, I'm going to do this writing workshop. And this is the first time that I've actually done a writing workshop in over 20 years. And I don't know. It's kind of cool.
Yeah.
We'll see. We'll see what happens.
It's another test.
It's another test. It's actually really scary, you know, because I know I'm good at planning. I don't know if I'm good at this, and I'm about to go into a workshop where I'm probably going to get torn apart.
Yeah, but you've got to have, you know, you've got to have a certain level of self-confidence to be able to put yourself forward. Like, I mean, you've got to be at a point where you go, I'm going to do this, right?
Or even, I would almost call it more desperation than self-confidence,
okay.
in that I have got to find ways to feed my soul right now. And so I'm almost at a moment right now where it's like, why not?
Right.
It's almost like, what do I have
What's
to lose?
What's the worst that could happen?
What's the worst that could happen?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's the moment I'm in right now. I need a creative outlet that is totally detached from work. And so that's what that's about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's forward to a future.
Yeah.
If we're sitting here in the wonderful office space of CodeWord, who I rarely mention because they're my generous hosts often.
Thank you.
To do these podcasts. If we did this in a year's time, what do you think we'd be talking about? What would you be talking about?
So it's interesting. So I worked about 7 or 8 years in the business before I did the truck, right? And then I'd say it was 7 years. And then I'm about 7 years out from when I started going again after the truck. So it's almost biblical. You know how the Bible talks about, like, we're talking about the Bible a lot today, but the Bible talks about 7 year cycles. So right now I'm in another one of those open, explore, but more importantly to what you referenced before, soul, like get the soul rebuilt again. I've been doing and putting stuff out in the world a lot, and I'm feeling pretty depleted right now. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I feel like with the blog post I wrote, maybe with this, I'm turning into like the poster child of failure for the industry or something.
Well, you're the only person who's willing to admit it.
But I think this is just part of the cycles, you know what I mean? And this is a cycle of life that I'm in.
Yeah.
Where I'm in a cycle where I need to go back into an exploration and recharge phase. And that's exactly what I'm in right now. And, you know, something that we talked a lot about at WW, you and I talked about before we started recording, was that with the utmost speed and amplification and chaos of modern society, the thing that I feel is really important is that we all have to learn how to navigate. And the only way that you can really navigate, for me, I think, and also for brands, is really understanding and fueling the core of, like, what are you all about? What do you believe? What do you want? And right now I'm in a refueling moment. And, you know, come July, I'm going to get back on the motorcycle, because for me, that's always been the best refueling. And I'm going to ride around for 5 months. Maybe 5 months. I don't know. It could turn into 5 months. But the point is right now it's open. It's all I know is that I need to rest. I need to refuel. I need to get the soul built back up again. And I just need to take a run at that. So in a year, I could still be on the road. We could be doing this, and I could be
calling
in from a yurt somewhere, you know.
Calling in from Montana.
I could get a new idea for a business, because I love building businesses. I think that's fun. But honestly, right now, there's something really delicious about saying, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
and
great.
Scary.
That's great.
Yeah.
I think that's a brilliant thing to end on, actually, because it's this idea of hope, and, you know, we're not quite sure what that future is, but we're gonna eagerly pursue it. So Heidi, thank you so much for
thank
your time.
You so much for
thank
having
you for
me
coming
yet.
In pretty early on a Monday morning.
All
and I really appreciated talking to you, and it was a really great conversation.
Thank you.
So thanks so much.
This is your host, Ed Cotton. Thank you so much for listening to Inspiring Futures. Until next time.